created, my body moves around. A lay teacher called this the cosmic chiropractor. It is usually pleasant, but can also be unpleasant. What are your thoughts about this, and how would you work with his energy? I think one of the main ways is really grounding the attention lower down in the body. Because when the mind gets concentrated and settled, if it's it can be sort of like the energy's up higher, and then it starts moving around. So that to really bring the energy down into the body, and then sometimes just keeping the eyes open so that you get used to what's it feel like to really not be drawn into that that kind of movement, and 'cause it's like really establishing a much clearer sense of body and mind and energy, so that there's a smoothness to it. And as that clarity of presence with the body and with the energy in the body, then you'll start to be able to. It's like letting it be. Channeling it more clearly, or more in a more balanced way. So then it because also when the body is that if it's swaying or moving or whatnot, it there's a level of distraction that's happening that we might not even be aware of. So it's like it really allows us to really settle much more when our sort of body, mind, and energy is more integrated. So that's what I said. Just sometimes that, like, giving the mind a bit more work to do in terms of making the, like, going through the body and feeling, say, with the breath, just where the body is, how it's feeling, is it relaxed, is it settled, and really trying to clarify in the moment what the body sensation is like, and then it's similar to what the in the mindfulness of breathing instruction, that experiencing the body, I breathe in, experiencing the body, I breathe out. So that's experiencing it more clearly, and then taking the awareness and really going through the body from the top of the head, and then really and just moving through the sensations in the body, through the body down to its lower extremities. And in particular, as we get more grounded, it might be helpful to pay attention to the breath at the abdomen, just so that you're bringing the energy down and getting to a good sort of solid base. You can experiment. If there is no self, why do you think we are here, alive on Earth, as individuals? The idiom in the suttas, I mean, sort of like, driven by craving and conditioned by ignorance, and we keep attaching to a sense of self. I mean, the Buddha says there is no self in the sense of non-self. But the habit is picking everything up and identifying with it as self, as me, as mine, what I want, what I think shouldn't be, and that's because we we keep doing that, then we keep coming back, and as long as we're still driven by that sense of identification with I, me, and mine, then we will we'll be looking for something to do in samsara, in the world. It's an endless sort of cycle. But then, of course, that's the habit, and that's the way out is what the Buddha gave us and said, yeah, this is possible to be completely liberated and free. Can dogs wake up? Seriously, I'm asking because I notice my doggies like to sit close to me when I do sitting meditation. No. in a word. Not in this life. Not in this life. But the reality that, and one of the conditioning factors for a being reborn in the animal realm is proximity to human beings, and that proximity then allows them to do good action, like sitting next to close to somebody. So it's like it feels good to sit close to somebody. So they create those conditions and that conditioning. So then that sets a dynamic in the mind that allows to be drawn to a human birth. The human birth is really, for the most part, where we have to be to wake up. There are some devas in some spheres of existence of the sort of celestial planes where it's possible, but generally they're having such a good time they forget about it. And animals, it's that the conditioning factor is delusion, is ignorance, and just not being able to break out of that conditioning in the animal realm, not able to really discern or make distinctions in a very clear way. So that's why the animal realm, or being reborn in an animal realm, is not considered very fortunate from a Buddhist perspective, where sometimes you'll hear people, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to be reborn as a deer in the forest? And you think, oh, wow, not if a mountain lion's chasing you. And then you got to live with all the sort of ticks and things that are on you all the time. You can't do anything about it. It's no fun. Please kindly explain the four pairs and the eight kinds of noble beings. Who are they? Where are they? How they became? When they became? When they become? The four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, are referring to the four stages of enlightenment. So beings who are on the path to stream entry, who have realized stream entry, who are on the path to once returning, and who've realized once returning, path to non-returning, and the realization of non-returning, and the path of arhantship, full enlightenment, and the realization of that. So that it's those four pairs, and they said those who, the four who are on the path, and the four who have realized that attainment, or that have come to that realization. And of course, when we do, it's in the chant, on the traditional chant, and that was one of the ones that really comes from the time of the Buddha. It's a refrain that goes through the suttas when the Buddha refers to the Sangha. In this context, because in many contexts, Sangha refers to monastic sangha, sometimes it refers to sort of community. But in this context, this is referring to, say, those who have are either on the path or who have realized the fruits of liberation. And being on the path doesn't just mean sort of practicing in some vague way, but that one has really cognized and understood what the practice is to bring about the fruit of that particular realization. So that when the Buddha refers to, say, suppatipanno, one who practices well, sort of one who's practicing in the right way, one who's practicing in the proper way, uccupatipanno, one who's practicing directly. There's the realization, here I am in the human condition, I have this opportunity to realize liberation, and one goes for it. This direct uchu means that one practicing directly. And then the nyaya patipanno is practicing, is translated as practicing insightfully in the... but nyaya is like practicing for true knowledge, or practicing depending on true knowledge, and so practicing for the realization of the Four Noble Truths. And then samiji patipanno is practicing with integrity, or practicing appropriately, practicing in a proper way that is going to lead to the fruits that one is dedicating one's efforts towards. So that reference to sangha can be either monastic or layperson, because I know there's lots of monastics who don't have any realizations, and there's lots of lay people who do have realizations. And it's so that reference of sangha, when we chant it, is to the noble sangha, those who have realized the fruit to some degree of the practice and are stable and steady within that. Please speak to judgment, both from the perspective of subject and object. Generally, when I think of the word judgment, then where my mind goes to is having a view or an opinion about something. Judging it in whether it conforms to my idea of whether it's right or wrong, or particularly in this context of being in those who grew up Catholic, is it really? So, oh, well, there's a lot of judgment around here. So that the judgments that we make about the world around us, other people, are they right, are they wrong, are they good, are they bad, do they conform to my preference, do they conform to my ideal, that type of judgment will almost invariably lead to suffering. When we're making those judgments and assumptions, then we tend to be, creating something external that sort of real and true. Judgments in terms of the subject are the judgments that lead to a sense of self, a sense of I, invariably leads to suffering. There's a word in the scriptural language, mana, which means, is translated as conceit, and it's different from the English word conceit. Usually, when we say conceit, then we're usually talking about feeling better than somebody. But from the, say, the Buddhist perspective, any sort of judgment about oneself in relationship to others is a conceit, because it's based on a wrong perception of selfhood or of I. So that the Buddha says there's 9 different forms of conceit. So that being inferior and thinking one's inferior, being inferior and thinking one's equal, being inferior and thinking one's superior, being equal and thinking one's inferior, being equal and thinking one's equal, being equal and thinking one's superior, being superior and thinking one's inferior, being superior and thinking one's equal, being superior and thinking one is superior. Any position is conceit, and it'll lead to suffering. So the judgments of self and comparison that we make of what I am, what is my value in relationship to that is based on a wrong perception of reality and truth, and it leads to suffering. Ajahn, I want to let go of things that I dislike as fast as possible. How can I do it? Well, with a lot of suffering, probably. with that beginning point, it's a setup. which doesn't mean, of course, that things that one dislikes shouldn't be let go of. But it's sort of being able to see it clearly and see the difficulty or problematic nature of the things that one dislikes. And even if it's disliking sort of unskillful qualities within oneself, again, we set up a dynamic of that comes from, say, vibhavatanha, the desire to push away, to not have, to not become, to annihilate it. And that'll lead to suffering. So that what one needs to do, if one wants to let go of things as fast as possible, is to see the suffering that's there, to feel the suffering that's there. Then the natural response, if one sees it really clearly, is to put it down. It's like if this was a, rather than being a cushion, it was a stove, and I pick up this bell, a stove that's on, and I pick this up, and it's sort of, oh gee, this is hot. I think I should maybe let go of this as fast as possible. And it's, yeah, I mean, it isn't how it works. It's sort of, see, you touch it and go, you want to put it down, because the experience is one of suffering. And it's seen clearly. It's felt very, very clearly. My breath seems to have a mind/ego of its own. Whenever I start to pay attention to it, it will breathe unnaturally. Sometimes my breathing gets laborious. Lately, I even... have a hard time breathing naturally when I'm not sitting. How do I approach my breathing gently so that it won't mind me watching it? you have to sneak up on it. so much of that the unnatural feeling is just trying too hard. Trying too hard, trying to be a good meditator, trying too hard to. I keep sort of saying, "Oh, try to see clearly." Well, then you try to really see clearly, and it gets all tangled up. Like with that, with mindfulness of breathing, if there tends to be. That the breath is feeling unnatural, laborious. Don't even use the breath. just take attention and be present with the body, present with whatever that is going on in the mind, but taking that sense of being present, and actually just sort of, okay, just feeling tension in the body, feeling tightness, and just loosening that, just relaxing, being able to relax the body, relax when the mind starts, I should be doing something. I'm supposed to be meditating. I came for a 10-day retreat. You know, I should be meditating. So, well, it's the knowing of oneself that is the meditating rather than the particular technique. So that to give oneself some space to relax. And then what happens? You'll oftentimes, the breath will start to become very comfortable. I mean, sometimes, I mean, I've done it myself where early days of meditating, mindfulness of breathing, and just really trying so hard. And then, an hour is finished and you're, okay, tired. Well, I think I'll just sit back and lean up against the wall and relax a bit. And then all of a sudden the breath is quite, stands out quite pleasantly. So after all that struggle, where it wasn't clear, and just the relaxing is what allows one to experience and see it more clearly, and for it to feel comfortable and good. Ajahn, how did Ajahn Chah communicate to the Western monks? Ajahn Chah had... one, he was very perceptive, intuitive, and but he knew human nature very well, so that he could really tune into people. And it was a question that, say, in Thailand, Thai people would ask Ajahn Chah. Because he was quite unique in terms of having many Western disciples, but Ajahn Chah grew up in a village in the northeast of Thailand. He finished grade one in his education, and in those days there just wasn't schools. He left home to go to the monastery when he was 9 years old, on his own choice, and so he lived in the monastery most of his life. And then, so he didn't ever have any knowledge of the English language. So people would ask him, "How is it that you don't speak English, and these Westerners, they come and they don't speak Thai? How do you teach them?" And he had different ways of answering. And one of the ways is, I remember him saying, "Oh, teaching Westerners, it's easy, just like teaching buffaloes. You pull them this way, pull them that way, they'll learn." Another time where he was asked the same question, and he said, it's like this, if you've got a glass of warm water, and you say this is warm water, and for him, he would say, well, that's in Thai, you would say, Nam Ron. He said, but, around here, I mean, that's what they call it in central Thailand, but around here, it's Nam Hon. And then in Chinese, it's something else. In English, it's hot water. In sort of Indian language, it's that. In French, it's something else. Language you'll never be able to actually be really sure what it is. So, but if you stick your finger in it, then you'll know what warm water is. And he said, practicing Dhamma and practicing the Buddha's teachings is like that. It's not about the language. It's about the experience. And so it's like, and the Four Noble Truths are not a theory or a words that you memorize so that you'll get it. It's pointing to experience. And when we are able to tune ourselves into experience, then we'll understand. And so that, for him, the language was, sort of, it's a secondary means of communication, sort of setting up situations, being in a place where you do the practice and you continue to do the practice within the container of the training. That's how you learn it. That's how you experience the teachings. How can one skillfully investigate feelings without simply getting lost in analytical thought? Probably the easiest way is paying attention to the feeling when one gets lost in analytical thought, because it'll be complicated, there'll be an element of suffering there. So then, 'cause we use the word investigation, and we have to use language and thinking sometimes, but really the best investigation takes place when the mind is very, very still and not formulating a lot of ideas and speculation. So it's just more of a direct seeing or a direct experiencing. A sort of rejigging our association of what we think, well, I should be investigating. And almost, so we're investigating, I should be thinking about it. But it's not necessarily the case. One can use the thinking process to help prod one or stimulate a particular reflection or perception. But in the end, it's the coming back to the experience, trying to see what something feels like in the context or the sphere of stillness and settledness. And then that around feeling, seeing what happens when there is a feeling, what rises out of that? Where does it go to? What does it stimulate? And of course, one doesn't need to analyze that. One just needs to recognize when the mind is moving and what feelings pushed it in a particular direction. Thanks for this opportunity and the helpful answers and talks. Can you speak a little more about the essential differences between working with vedana, the hindrances, and mind states, and the differences and similarities between quote-unquote spiritual use of these and more psychological, personal, growth-oriented? Is there a difference? On a certain level, there isn't a big difference between, say, working with vedana or feeling or the hindrances or mind states, in the sense that what one's trying to see, or what is helpful to see, is their underlying characteristics, so that whether it's feeling or mental states or the hindrances themselves, it isn't so much about the content, it's about the characteristic of impermanence, uncertainty, its changing nature, that characteristic, or the characteristic of its unsatisfactory nature, the tinge of suffering or dissatisfaction that's there, and the non-self aspect, whether it's a feeling or hindrances or a mental state, a mind state, one can't sort of build an I, a me, a mine around them, of course, without creating more complication and suffering. The differences are more in terms of content, you know, in the sense that it's very discrete and you know, there are these different feelings. They're very separate. There's a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, a neutral feeling. So that there's differences. There's, with the hindrances, there's a whole different expression and range of emotion and feeling that goes with ill will and aversion or doubt. But the differences in terms of working with them would be one's own interest or one's own what feels more important to one, and that would be very personal. And also even for ourselves, it changes over time. Some things that you feel important or meaningful at one particular time, and then that can change. So that there's those kind of differences, but it's more, say, quantitative rather than the similarity that underlies it is its characteristics, its nature. And we need to pay attention to the nature of things. Maybe differences and similarities between spiritual use of these and more psychological, personal, growth-oriented. Of course, yeah, there's differences and similarities in the sense that differences, a very clear difference would be in terms of, say, a spiritual use from a Buddhist perspective, would be seeing of a non-self nature. And oftentimes, sort of psychological, personal, growth-oriented would be sort of building up the sense of self or trying to establish a successful self, whatever that is. But then, of course, a similarity is that, you know, the tools would be for a sense of well-being. And a sense of well-being, a sense of happiness. I mean, that's sort of bottom line in whatever we do as human beings. And we're seeking happiness and well-being. And, you know, we seek it in different ways. You know, we use the tools of Buddhist practice to quite consciously create a sense of well-being, but it has a very nurturing quality to it when we pay attention to generosity and giving and sharing, or to virtue and precepts. So it has a very positive effect on our life, on our mind, and so that that psychological benefit or personal growth, to really grow in terms of virtue and generosity and kindness, that brings a lot of happiness. So that seeing clearly how that dynamic of how these fundamental qualities that the Buddha points to and Buddhist tradition points to, they help us on a very personal and psychological level just to feel a sense of well-being and lack of fear and a sense of trust and confidence. And those are when it comes from a very clear spiritual quality, then it has a very stabilizing effect. Might you speak about the heart in Buddhism? I think I addressed that. It might have been the first day. But that in Buddhism, there's not a distinction between the heart and the mind. They're the same thing. And you'll find that's why you'll find us, when we're teaching, alternating back and forth sometimes, because in the English language, then the sort of mind is more intellectual, cognitive. The heart is more emotional, feeling tone. But there aren't two separate words in Buddhism. It's just the word citta, and it encompasses that whole range of expression. Would you mention one more time how to watch feelings rise and pass away? You can only do it by watching. It's a really important aspect to be reminding oneself of, in the sense that the way the mind works, we have to rely on concepts and ideas and attention and mindfulness, so that by framing our attention, by setting up an intention to be attentive to feelings, then we start to notice them. And also sort of comes back to a certain extent to the hindrances, in the sense of noticing when we get caught in doubt, in the sense of I'm not able to see these feelings clearly. Am I doing it the right way? And that then we undermine ourselves, and then it's sort of, I don't know how to see feelings clearly. But probably what's happening is one's not seeing the hindrance of doubt clearly. So coming back and identifying, hey, what's the particular hindrance? Well, why aren't feelings clear to me? So then it's seeing that aspect of whether it's restlessness or dullness or doubt. Then when that's identified, and also by setting that intention of, okay, I want to see the nature of feeling more clearly. So then the mind can go in that direction because one's framed it. If the Buddha were alive today, what question would be most important for you to ask of him? In terms of questions, I would be asking about what type of practice, what ways of training would be suitable. That's my particular bent in terms of if I had that opportunity. But that's, I kind of lean towards the nuts and bolts aspects of things, rather than if the Buddha were here, I'd be able to ask him about the different realms of existence and all that. But I think, to me, what's really important and what the Buddha gave us are tools that we can use ourselves. And then, of course, we have to develop the skill in using them. Okay. Can you repeat the instruction regarding breathing in and use words, piti, happiness, mental formations? There are four instructions, thank you. Okay, this today was the on the section on Vedana, on feeling. So breathing in, experiencing piti or joy, I breathe in. Experiencing piti or joy, I breathe out. experiencing happiness or sukha, I breathe in, experiencing happiness, I breathe out. Experiencing citta sankhara, which is like mind conditioner, I breathe in, experiencing the mind conditioner, I breathe out. Or formations can be used, but it's probably sankhara is more like the the force that constructs things, that can, the, so that the and as I spoke about, as I say, the building blocks of what constructs the mind and the mental states and the mental formations are feeling and perception. And then the last one is calming the mind conditioners. I breathe in, calming the mind conditioners. I breathe out. So really settling them, bringing them to a place of tranquility. Was Ajahn Chah fully liberated? Do you know any living being who is? Most people thought he was. Of course, I knew people who didn't. But I certainly thought he was. Of course, it depended on the day and the mood. I had a lot of confidence in him. And I've met other beings who but on a certain level, there's no way of really knowing. If you asked Ajahn Chah, you know, are you fully liberated? And be uncertain how he would reply. But I can assure you, he wouldn't say, oh yeah, sure. I remember him one time saying, you know, some people like to speculate and think about, you know, me as some kind of special teacher or having some kind of special attainments. And really, you know, it's kind of like a tree with birds in it that chatter and whatnot. It's just the chattering of the birds. And the tree doesn't really think about it. When examining awareness, such as sensing the breeze on the skin, is there a breeze or just sensation? The breeze is a supposition and a perception and a concept that we derive out of the experience that we have. We actually don't know anything other than sight, smell, taste, touch, and mental formations. You know, we build up a body of assumptions, and some of them, you know, may conform with reality, and some of them might not. And, you know, there's a lot of empirical evidence out there for such things as breezes. How we know it is through our experience. And then, of course, the extrapolation through various sort of evidence. But it's important to sort of step back and remind oneself of that, because we do tend to concretize and reify the external world. And when we do that, we end up making a lot of assumptions. So that to come back to, you know, well, what is it that I'm experiencing? And, you know, basically, you know, it's the sense of touch. And then we make some deductions and conclusions from that sense of touch. But the foundation of that is in the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling and the actual pressure or hardness or softness, the feeling of expansion or contraction that's around it, which are just the how we experience the four primary elements. In Buddhism, when they think it's the earth element, fire element, wind element, water element, it's not so much, say, the external qualities of something earth being, but it's more how's it experienced. It's experienced as something that has, whether it's heavy or light, it has some weight, whether it's rough or smooth, whether it's hard or soft. And that's how we experience the earth element. Say the water element is experienced as something that is both, there's a cohesive quality to water. It's something that makes things flow together and join together. And of course there's the sensation of it being wet and the fluid quality. And of course fire element is either heat or the lack of heat. Air, sort of movement. So that those are just sort of functions that we can experience. And we experience through the sense of touch, we experience it through hearing, through seeing, and through our sense bases. So that becoming very familiar with those sense bases, so that we see how the whole construct of experience is built up through that, through those fundamental sense doors, and then the extrapolations that come from that. What can help morph endurance into patience? It's good to define patience, because there is a tendency to think patience is just sort of enduring something until it's over. But patience is much more a quality of being able to be present with experience, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, but to be willing to be with an experience. So the quality of patience is a very important spiritual quality, because we're not running away from or shifting our attention away. We can be patient with it. We can be present for something, even if it's really difficult, or you're bringing up fear, or bringing up anxiety, or bringing up aversion. We can come back and be present for it and not be reactive. We don't have to get caught in the compulsion of reaction. And that's more what patience is from a practice point, is that just being able to not get caught in the reactions that we have, and just being present with something. And it's that patience that is, it's actually one of the perfections, the barami. It's a spiritual quality that allows us to experience things in a way that we can then not be intimidated or shaken or moved by it. So we can be patient with it. Just being in the human condition, you need a lot of patience. There's all sorts of things that are just, they pull us and push us in different ways. And sometimes the mind is screaming out to react in some way. And just just come back to patience. There's a teaching that is called the Owadapatimokkha, and it's like a core teaching that the Buddha gave, and then he referred to it over and over again. And one of the lines is the Kanti Paramang Tapo Titika, and it says, patience is the supreme destroyer of defilement, and destroyer in the sense of burning up. Patience burns up the defilements. It is able to undermine them and let them sort of drift off in smoke and haze and dust, and there's nothing left. Dhammas arise and cease, nothing personal. How does that relate to our personal karma? Well, I mean, they coexist. And in the sense that dhammas arise and cease, there's nothing personal, but you're still going to have to receive the fruits of your actions. God, it's a bummer, isn't it? Yeah, it's not. You can't just sort of write it off as, oh, it's just arising and ceasing phenomena, no problem. The reality of how karma works is that there's a result, and nothing personal, but nobody else gets it either. What are hallmarks or signs or markers of stream entry? Is this a realistic goal for a modern layperson? Understanding we hold goal lightly. Yeah, absolutely. It's more than a realistic goal. It's an appropriate goal. It's a proper goal. If you're going to have a goal in life, this is the one to have. The most common hallmark or sign or marker of stream entry is confirmed innocence, confirmed confidence, confirmed faith, and sort of like a very firm faith in the Buddha, a firm faith in the Dhamma, a firm faith in the Sangha, and a natural adherence to the virtue that is praised by the noble ones, such as the five precepts, and that is harmless and leading to concentration. So it's like those. That's not so difficult. It's not so far away. The things that have to be dealt with or relinquished to realize stream entry. The first is say identity view. So that creating the identity, the me, the I, the me, the mine, around this body and this mind. Sort of it's that being able to see through or see clearly that it's never going to be self. It's a force of nature that one has no real control over. That one has to follow those conditions in nature. So that sense of identity view. And then the attachment to precepts and practices is a way of translating it. But what it means is, it doesn't mean there's no, you don't have to bother with precepts or practices. What it means is that one has the view that if I only just keep this set of precepts, then that's going to purify me. Or if I only just do this practice, it's going to purify me. If I just watch my breath long enough, I'm going to be purified and liberated. Again, there are these precepts and practices, but they have to be held in the right way. They're tools that we have to learn how to use skillfully, so that the clarification of how to use those tools skillfully is a hallmark of a stream enterer. And then the last one is skeptical doubt, and just being plagued by the doubt of you know, is this, was the Buddha really enlightened? Are the teachings actually beneficial? Is there something else that I should be doing? Can I even do this? All of those kind of skeptical doubts, those are resolved in stream entering. There's a very beautiful teaching. I think Sariputta gives the teaching, and he's asked, say, what are the conditions for stream entry? Say, what are conditioning factors for stream entry? And he gives four conditions for the realization of stream entry. Two are external and two are internal. First is association with wise people. And the second is hearing the Dhamma, hearing the true Dhamma. So that association with those who are wise, good beings, and then that hearing the teachings, hearing the Dhamma, hearing the explanations of the what the true teachings are, or the true Dhamma is. So those are external conditions. Two internal conditions are something I mentioned the other day, is one, yoniso manasikara, wise attention. So that wise attention, skillful reflection, appropriate attention, those are all translations of this term. Attention that goes to the root of things. Knowing how to and training oneself in directing one's attention in a skillful way. And the last one is in Pali, is Dhammanu Dhamma Patibhata. Practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, which is an interesting reflection, because, you know, oftentimes we practice Dhamma in accordance with our views and opinions, or we practice Dhamma in accordance with our preferences and our laziness, or we practice Dhamma in accordance with what we think somebody else thinks that we should be doing, and all of those permutations. And that, you know, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma is sort of really tuning in to, well, what's the essence of the Dhamma? What's the Buddha really wanting us to do? Another explanation of that, or another way of looking at that little phrase, because anu means like following, and one way is like learning how to put the little Dhammas in the big Dhammas. So practicing so that one's building the foundations of practice, so that it's leading to things which are more refined, more clear, more conducive to the goal that we're seeking. And as I said, it's a very practical goal, and it's not beyond the capability of anybody. And certainly in the Buddha's time, many, 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 many of the lay community were stream enterers, were once returners, non-returners. But mostly in terms of each level of refinement, it starts to get a bit more selective. But stream entry is a very accessible, and it's something to just set as a goal in practice. I mean, don't torture yourself with it. Don't create a lot of suffering and judgment around it, but just to take it in that this is possible. The Buddha's teachings are a valid way of freeing the heart and realizing for oneself that suffering can cease, that realization as possible. So it's saying having one's view to hold that. Okay, I got through them all tonight. So we can have a quick break and come back for puja. I went a bit long tonight.